You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Concierge Coaches, but Around the Block, presented by Federal Prison Authority. Boy, I tell you, I was just in the time machine here a minute ago, so I've got to get with it. So Around the Block, and folks, that's what we're going to do. We're going to take y'all around the block. We have a special guest with us today. Going to get to him in just one second, but today's episode is brought to you in part by FCI Big Spring. Big Spring is a satellite low 4 hours west of Dallas-Fort Worth, along with a satellite camp. Yes, folks, they wanted me to work there. They actually gave me a recruiting bonus, but I turned them down to stay in Dallas-Fort Worth. So today we have a special guest, folks. This is just a great opportunity because we have with us somebody who experienced, I guess, BOP corrections history. This gentleman with us, Dory Sater, actually received a CARES Act-style release, and he also received benefits under the First Step Act. And also, he was on home confinement for quite a while, so he can talk about home confinement issues. And also, we can talk about his reintegration, if you will, back into society. Now, no worries. He's no longer in BOP custody, so everybody can rest easy out there. Just put your pencils down. He's on his supervised release. So, Dory, thanks for coming on the show, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Bruce. It's good to be with you guys. And hello, Susan. How are you?
It's nice to meet you. I've seen you post on the page.
Yes. Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah, he's a regular contributor on our Facebook group, a voice of reason among former inmates, which is always a blessing to have. A lot of former inmates may have more, let's say, opinions. But Dory's objective and calls it like he sees it and kind of bases his opinions on facts and not feelings. And so that's what we want to bring on to the show today. Well, Dory, I know your experience. Can you, whatever you're willing to share, right? But kind of walk us through. I know that you were at a minimum security facility. But kind of walk us through how you got CARES Act. Kind of the paperwork. How long till you get out? How long you're on in home confinement? And just kind of walk us through.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to do this. For most of my time, I was at Lewisburg Camp. From what I hear, of all the places, that's not such a bad place to be. But when I first got there, everything was kind of, it was early 2022. I think it was March of 22. Everything was regarding FSA and CARES Act was kind of like up in the air. Nobody really understood what was going on. And, I think at the time the BOP was doing manual calculations for FSA. And every time you went to your case manager, you would either get some credits or there would be an adjustment. And it was a really down time for a lot of inmates. And of course for me, because I had just started and I had experienced the legal system from the other side where I used to represent people. I used to be a lawyer for 24 years. I used to represent people and they would tell me, oh my God, it's so bad. You got to do something to help me get out. And, in the past I always said, well, it can't be, this is USA, it can't be as bad, so experience it from both sides, really is an enlightening thing. So, I guess I would say I got there really, got started in May, with my time at Lewisburg. I stayed busy. I worked in landscaping, and then I got wind of the CARES Act, and people were filing to try to get to release to home confinement to serve out the remainder of their time if they had medical conditions or something that would support, the fact that you'd be at risk if you got COVID in such a confined space. So I should add, at this time, my mother was suffering from cancer. I wanted to do my time at home if I could. So I thought, well, what's the harm in applying for this? And so I did my research. I listened to inmates. I read what I could read. And I found out that, hey, if I put in a BP-9 asking for CARES Act consideration, then you know, maybe I can get it. And I did that early on. I think I did that in September of 2022. And because I had high blood pressure, diabetes, and a bunch of other stuff, I got approved for it. Now, when I first got approved, I thought, great, when do I go on home confinement? But of course, as I discovered, there are time, you had to do minimum time. I think it was either half of your time if you had a longer sentence, or 25% of your time and be less than 18 months to the door. That was a requirement. So it became counting the calendar days. Oh, when am I at 25%? And you would think something like that would be straightforward, but with FSA, taking off 10, 15 days a month, thinking, all right, well, I'm getting closer to 25 because they're going to count that credit towards my 25. But of course, that wasn't the case either. So there was all these moving parts. And of course, and then it came to the point where I had this approval. As long as I meet my time requirements, they would put the referral in and send me to home confinement. And then right around the time I was coming up on my time, the 25%, that's when CARES was being closed down. So it was a lot of anxiety. Am I going to make the cut? Am I not going to make the cut? And at first, everybody was, you know, the staff over there were saying that there's not going to be time for you. You're not going to make the cut. But ultimately, I think they went even beyond the time. And I got my referral and was released in May of 23 to home confinement to serve out the remainder of my time, helping my mom, spending time with my mom and dad. And, you know, and it worked out pretty good for me. So that's how I got the CARES Act relief.
So let me interrupt you for a second. For those of folks that are listening that haven't been in prison, are family members, you were at Lewisburg Camp. Can you describe, was that an open bay? Were you in cubicles? Did you have individual rooms? What was the camp kind of set up?
Yeah. Like? So Lewisburg Camp is, there's three buildings. There's two main buildings in the main area, and they're kind of like military barracks. There are cubicles. When I first got there, everybody was double bunked in one building because they were doing repairs on another building, air conditioning and things like that. And that was really kind of a crowded situation, high tension, because, you know, you have, I think there were 11 or 12 cubes on each side. So 24 on one level, 24 on the next level, and then on the other side, 24 and 24. So everybody was crammed in together. And then there was an RDAP building, and that was the same kind of thing. That was more of an open bay thing. So, yeah, so that was a lot of tension and adjusting to. But then when they opened the other building, it became, everybody got their own bunk and their own cube. And, you know, it was manageable. You know, nobody likes to be confined like that, but manageable. There's no cell doors. You know, basically, if you were at your bunk during the stand up count times and overnight counts, you had no problems, freedom of movement. You know, go to the library. Lewisburg had a full gym with weights and treadmills and everything. There was baseball activities, soccer, you name it, you know, church. So there was a lot of freedom of movement, and that made the time go by a little bit easier, because you can remain, if you wanted to, you could remain active and do things. So, and then there wasn't a lot of, you know, it's a minimum security. So there weren't a lot of guards always walking around, mm-hmm. and, you know, searching stuff. They would walk around. They would interact with people. And I found that if you were respectful to them, they were respectful to you, and never had any problems with that.
So for someone facing going to federal prison, staying busy was kind of really helped you with kind of your, not just your physical well-being, but like your headspace, your mental well-being.
Absolutely. And there's two kinds of jobs that you could have in there. And I tell this at people who ask. The first kind is the job in name only, where you know, your job is to pick up litter in the yard or something like that. And the other one is where you actually work. And so I took the landscaping job because Lewisburg has 1,200 acres. And there's a lot of grass to cut, a lot of things to do. And that kept me busy and working from 7 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. every day. Come back, take a shower, do the 4 o'clock count, get something to eat, and then sit in the library from 4 to 9, you know, reading stuff, understanding FSA, trying to understand it, because it was so new that nobody really had a chance. So I spent a lot of time researching FSA program statements, anything that was available in the library. And before I knew it, it was time for your bonk at 9 o'clock count.
All right.
And did that. And then there was time to play chess, watch TV until from 9 to midnight. And then did the same thing the next day.
Right.
And that really does, like, getting out, doing some hard work. Number one, it's good for your headspace. And the second thing is that if you're a hard worker, you get noticed, you know, in a good way. You know, the guards, the staff, they say, oh, you know, yeah, that's Sater there. You know, he's the guy who power washes the walkways or whatever work they ask you to do, you know, as opposed to getting noticed to be for being a troublemaker or something like that, which is something you don't want to do when you're in federal prison.
Right. So you got approved for CARES Act. And yes, you went out in May. That was right under the wire.
Yeah.
Right under the gun. I was in DC at that time. So tell us about that transition to home confinement. You got the furlough transfer.
So I got a furlough. You know, I went up a week before, gave my fingerprint, was given instructions on where I needed to be, and I was given a furlough to, you know, my parents were able to pick me up and take me from Lewisburg to the Scranton Halfway House. When I went in, I filled out all the halfway house paperwork, did basically their orientation program in a couple hours, and was given an ankle monitor and instructions on what I needed to do if I needed to leave the house or work or things like that. So that I can get into that a little bit. Halfway house versus home confinement. I sometimes feel that home confinement restricted because you had to put together your schedule a week in advance, you know, with the hours. You're allotted certain amount of hours for leisure, a certain amount of hours for work, but you had to fill out your schedule and you had to call when you left the house, call when you arrived at your work or your destination, and call when you arrived back at home. And then every night there was a call around 11 or 12 just to make sure you were home on the landline. So that's that process. Every Thursday by noon, I had to have my schedule in. And, you know, they were very accommodating if there were changes or something suddenly happened. And again, if you approach them with respect and ask them, you know, hey, I didn't put this on my schedule, but I need 2 hours to do this. Most of the times it was approved as long as you still had the hours.
So did you have to go back and forth to the halfway house at all?
I reported once a week, just a check-in. I think they did urine analysis every week just to make sure. I mean, even though it wasn't part of my case, I think they were required to check to make sure that there was nothing untoward going on.
Right.
And you know, never had any problems with any of that.
And how long were you on?
From May to January of 24.
Okay.
So January of 2024, January 5th, and it's interesting because I'm sure we're going to talk about this, but I kept watching my dates shortened by 15 days. So originally it was into March when I first got onto home confinement, and then every month the calculator would run and it would move back 15 days and so on and so forth. So eventually I got to my case manager in my December, the last week of December check-in. And I said, look, when it runs in January, it's going to move it back to January 5th. And that should be my date then. She's like, absolutely, we're waiting for you. So it ran early January, or I think it might have been towards the end of December, or ran maybe twice in December of that year. Anyway, when January 5th came, they called me in, cut off the bracelet, and I went to probation. It was a great feeling, one of the greatest feelings, you know, finally to be out of custody.
Excellent. So any other thoughts? I mean, you only spent a few hours at the halfway house in the check-ins, but you had talked about the restrictiveness of home confinement. You know, a lot of folks are like, got to get to home confinement, got to get there, get out of prison. You know, it sounds like you did good with it, but it sounds like you had to be like, really organized as far as, like you said, providing your schedule and what changes might come up. Beyond that, like, what were the limitations? Like, could you go to the grocery store?
Yeah, as long as you put it, you know, you're allowed time to go to the grocery store. I say it's more restrictive, but I don't think I would have taken any other option, as restrictive as it could have been, because ultimately you're home, you're eating home-cooked meals, you know, you can order takeout, whatever, have them deliver it to you, you know, you're watching, you're laying in your couch or bed watching TV, so, you know, you get your peace and quiet time, which, you know, I don't think I would have traded that. So even though there was a lot of hurdles and a lot of steps you had to take to make sure you had time to go to the park or to go shopping or, you know, go job hunting, you know, as long as you put that on your calendar, your schedule, got it approved, there was no problems. And did your call-ins, you know, call in, call out, there was no problems.
And I think being prepared for that, and it sounds like you got a good rundown when you got to the halfway house about your expectations, and, you know, so that's what for your mom.
And people who post on your Facebook group would ask about it. I tell them, you know, in a lot of senses, there's a lot more to do as far as, you know, getting time when you're on home confinement. But again, I say, like I said before, I don't think I would have traded that for any other situation. It was so much more comfortable being home in my own shower, you know, all that stuff. So,
yeah, absolutely. So then you transition to probation. Bruce, I should let you jump in. I'm talking. Oh, Bruce's doesn't even have a mic working.
Bruce's his mic is quiet. Problems. Yeah.
Yeah. Not at all. Can't hear you at all. So tell us about the transition to your probation.
Yeah, so, I mean, the very same day after they cut the bracelet off, they told me I had to report immediately, and I did, and it was like anything else, like an intake. You know, I wait maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, going over the terms and conditions. Now, I didn't have a lot of terms and conditions. I had a attempted bank fraud charge over a $50,000 loan that was already paid back, so I didn't have any restitution. I didn't have any special conditions, like, you know, anything. Some people would stay off of social media or stay off computers or things like that. I had nothing like that. So it was pretty smooth and seamless. You know, I speak to them every once in a while. They'll call and check in with me. I guess I'm on, I think they call it low intensity supervision. Because there's not a lot of conditions, there's no drug testing or anything like that, so they don't really have to see me a lot. The only real condition I have right now that I feel that is not a bother, but something I always address, is if I'm leaving the district or have to travel somewhere, I make sure to get permission or to let them know.
Right. About communication.
Yeah, communication. And also, I filed I served 1 year on supervised release. After my 1 year in January, I filed a petition for early termination. And I don't think the probation department doesn't really object to it, but, you know, it's still pending in front of the court. We'll see what happens.
Absolutely. But following all the rules, having that good communication, that's how you establish that rapport with probation, to have that recommendation to the court. You know, if that's even, you know, if it's a possibility, it means you got to have that, the recommendation of your probation officer, and the good communication working with them is how you make that happen.
That's right. You know, and anybody who asks me about my experience, I kind of quote to them Shawshank Redemption, where I think it's the inmate Boggs, and he's coming out of the hole, and he says to them, "It's your world, boss." You know, and that's what I tell people. It's their world. You know, they make the rules. You know, you can fight where you want to fight, but ultimately it's their rules. You got to live by it, and challenge where you could challenge through the legal process or through the administrative remedy process, you know, but do it in a respectful way. That's the way you're going to get anything done.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're with probation, you're getting back out into the world, working, doing things, you know, tell us about that journey, kind of becoming a regular person again.
Well, yeah, there's two aspects to it. It's the mental aspect where I still don't know if everything is back. There's still anxiety that surrounds that whole period of my life. And yeah, I was a short timer, but it just, it's hard. It takes a toll on people. Mm-hmm. So there's that mental aspect. And there's also the, you know, I can't go back to practicing law until I get my license back, and hopefully in about 18 months or so. That looks like you know, when that's a possibility. But getting a regular job, you know, even with somebody like Home Depot or Lowe's is not that easy. You know, you get background checks, and of course, it comes up when you're done with your time. So that was a humbling experience.
And how do you answer that question when you're filling out that application? And you know, there's the whole ban the box to not have to check if you've been convicted on the application, and at least give you that opportunity to talk to people. And a lot of companies have shifted that way anyway. But like, how do you answer that question? You're sitting in that interview, trying to get a job. How do you talk about that?
You gotta be honest. You know, you gotta honest and tell them the story. And you know, I mean, this is still the United States of America, right? The land of second chances. And you know, you hope you impose on them that you know you're a decent person who's paid their debt to society, and see how they handle it. Unfortunately, Susan, I think that corporate, like people like Walmart or Home Depot, when they do the background check, there's not a lot of discretion, I don't think, because that's what happened to me. You know, every time the background check came back, that was it. So I could have been depressed and sat on it, but I still have my legal knowledge. I have this new prison knowledge. So I consult with lawyers. I consult with, you know, so most recently, lawyers, federal defense lawyers who have prisoners going in, they'll ask me a bunch of questions. Hey, my guy's going in. Here's the questions that we have. Can you give us some comment on what he should do to prepare for his first day or his self-surrender and things like that? And of course, I'll write a detailed email to him, and he shares that with his client. And, you know, that's an avenue for me to use the knowledge I have both legally and my experience to help people. And hopefully it does.
Absolutely. I was going to say,
you know, Bruce, in the legal game.
Oh, there you go. We can hear you now.
Oh, thank God. well, that's good that you're going to be able to get your license back.
I'm going to try. I mean, there's an application process. You petition the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. You have a hearing. I mean, and if you've done good with your life, paid your debt to society, there's really no reason that it shouldn't be restored. And I'm hopeful to have that sooner rather than later, as soon as possible. I mean, I miss doing what I used to do.
I understand.
Well, you had a long career and you were doing well. So I understand missing that. I'm recently retired and I'm still getting used to not doing what I was doing and embarking on an adventure with Bruce here. So
And you know, listen, I like trials. I was a trial lawyer, so I like to get up in front of a judge or jury, think on my feet, make arguments. So that's the kind of stuff I miss. But you know, I'm still kind of plugged into it now, especially with when I consult with lawyers for their clients. You know, I feel like I'm talking to former colleagues. You know, and I could help. Oh. You know, because a lot of people don't understand like the post-conviction process. Yeah, you know, lawyers represent somebody, they get sentenced, and then that's it. You know, they're done. So
have you read our books yet?
I have, yes.
Okay, both of them?
Well, not both of them, just the one. I wasn't aware of the second one.
Second one we actually wrote with lawyers in mind.
Yeah, you gotta see that. Yeah. I'll send you a link for the second one.
Yeah.
Please do, actually, yeah.
I saw it when I was still working, and when Bruce and I talked about it, I was like, you know, this is a real problem. I used to talk about standing mainline and having folks come up to me and say, but my lawyer said, and then I have to break it to them that their lawyer is not a case manager and their lawyer doesn't understand how the Bureau views your PSR. So yeah, so we wrote the second book with the legal community in mind. Before it's finalized is important.
Yeah. Well, so, what I'm doing now is like I actually have another thing that I'm kind of doing with lawyers. I'm preparing a CLE on, you know, how to prepare your clients for prison. You know, hopefully that gets approved in the next couple of days, and be out and sitting with lawyers, giving the presentation on all that kind of stuff. Kind of, it's like a primer on everything. I mean, there's no way you could sit in front of somebody and talk about First Step Act, Second Chance Act, all that stuff in one go. But I don't think lawyers, trial lawyers, defense lawyers really have any idea what this stuff is. And that's my experience. So try to help them out, and hopefully they can help their clients out.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to bring up, kind of give you credit. There's a lot of extra people that have gotten out of that facility because of you, that were the RDAP guys. They were, gosh, how
Yeah.
There must have, you know, and so, you know, thanks to you, you referred those guys.
Right over to you.
Door was like five or six or seven 628 fixes back in the day, Susan. So, yeah, just commend you for helping your comrades.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, their family would call me and say, hey, you know, obviously wanted to limit contact because, you know, that something that was prohibited. So I would talk to a father, husband, wife, whatever, and I'd say, listen, I can't do anything for you, but I know what, that somebody that could, you know, give Bruce a call, and it always seemed to work out.
Yeah, so we appreciate that. That's before Susan was out, but Susan remembers my requests, so on those and others. But yeah, that was very good that you did that. So, you know, and I also like the fact that you talk about how home confinement is a little bit more stressful than, like you said, then, you know, because you got to be structured as well. You got to submit your time. You got to be, you got to be on the ball. You got to know what you're doing. So,
plus you got a big thing on your ankle too.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine your prior experience just as a professional, you kept a calendar. You know, as a lawyer, it wasn't like you were flying by the seat of your pants through life.
That's right.
You led a calendared life. Professionally.
That's right.
So I would imagine those same, you know, you just kind of shift that mindset to,
right,
you know.
And you know, it actually would work too for a blue collar guy who works 9 to 5, because then that's easy. You put 8:30 a.m., leave the house, 5:30 p.m., arrive. And if you wanted to go out to dinner, you get, you know, 4 hours a week or whatever it was, you know, all right, 7 o'clock to 9 p.m., you know, you put that on your calendar. So I think it would be easy, but there is that you must do it. It must be consistent. You don't want to be the guy that just doesn't call in or anything like that. So, but yeah, for me, it was easy. For me, keeping a calendar was easy. It was no problem. And like I said, I enjoyed it much better than being anywhere else.
Absolutely. I think a lot of folks not connected to the federal prison system, either having been in custody or a loved one, kind of sometimes on TV get this idea about Club Fed and the minimum security camps, and that somehow it's a walk in the park. And I would regularly say, you know, yes,
certainly not. Security, certainly not.
But, you know, you can't get up and make yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and get a cold glass of milk at midnight because you want to. You know, you're not going anywhere at midnight.
Yeah, you can't do that, right? You can't do it. You could go to the TV room, but you're not going to watch. Chances are, you're not going to watch what you want either. With, you
know, absolutely,
50 guys wanted to watch the same thing. That, you know, So there's, and plus it's being cut off. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no, hey, let me look this up on Google, or when does this movie come out, or what is? Oh, I remember I read this book. What book was that I read? You can't just pick up your phone and Google search, and then go to the library and pick up the book that you want, you know?
Right.
So it's being disconnected from family.
Yeah. You talked about your mother was sick and your mom and the stress of that and not being able to be there.
Right.
So like no one should get the idea that just because you're in a minimum security facility doesn't mean it's somehow cushy.
Right. It's not cushy because there's, you know, yes, my mom was sick, so she was having a biopsy or a procedure. I had to wait till I was able to call. You know, the phones weren't on at certain hours, or, you know, you had to wait for the phones to go on and make sure you had enough minutes to call and then call and check. And even that was only 15 minutes maximum. So it's a sense of isolation. You're isolated, and that leads to anxiety, and anxiety leads to depression. And on top of all that, you know, when you have 290 guys in the same facility, you know, there's egos and, you know, this group is doing something over here that's loud and noisy and all you want to do is sleep, you know, so, but you can't. So you have to adapt. It's not simple. It's not simple at all. You know, I don't think, anybody. I don't wish it on anybody. The isolation is the hardest part.
Right.
But you know, you adapt and you make the best of it. You meet people in there. You know, you have your little close group of friends. You'll sit in the library or wherever you sit, and you talk about things as normal as it can be.
Right.
You know, there's baseball games and minimum security. If you wanted to do that, you know, it's just not the same. It's not.
Right. Absolutely.
It's punishment. I understand. You know, yes, it's punishment. That's the price of it. But it takes a toll on people.
Absolutely. You know, Bruce, you want to say something?
Yeah. When some people go in, they feel like, oh my God, how am I going to recover from this? There's that sense of hopelessness. Now that you're at the end of it, did you have those feelings when you first started your term? And then where are you today with that mentally?
Absolutely. The first few months, even, I felt like everybody was looking at me in a weird way. Now you have this overriding anxiety. I don't know where it comes from or what it is, but, and then you tend to isolate. So in prison, everything was loud and lights and bright. So I found myself liking quiet and dark and isolation because I was around people and everything was noisy the whole time. So the first few months were really hard adjusting. And then, you know, you get more freedoms, like walks outside, even on home confinement, a scheduled walk for an hour or something like that. And then you start experiencing that and the light again. And soon enough, the light overpowers the darkness and you start to find something that gives you peace. And, you know, and that builds on itself. And there's still times where, you know, I feel, you know, on guard, anxious or whatever, but yeah, it definitely gets exponentially better over the seasons. So I'd say looking back on when I first arrived in May of 23, it's two different people. I'm a different person now. It just feels much more comfortable being back. I mean, even though I was, you know, less than 2 years total in custody, it does. Even short timers, I think it's just that isolation, the taking away, that really hits the ego, especially of men. I think.
Yeah.
Well, and you entered at a really.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean. I just wanted to mention when I first got in, it was COVID, so there were days, 10, 15 days of isolation. You know. And at Lewisburg, it was in these 6x6 kind of dome rock cells. And they didn't open the door for you to go outside. They opened the slot to give you your tray. And every other day or every 2 days, they would open it up for 15 minutes so you could go shower. And that was it. And that was two weeks where you don't have any concept of what time it is unless you look and see what meal it is. You know, hey, what's coming through the door? Oh, eggs. So, yeah, must be morning. So no contact with anybody, no phones, no letters, no books, nothing. So that kind of isolation is very, very difficult. And they did that at Lewisburg because of COVID. You know, it was a, what was it called? The quarantine period. Make sure everything was all right, you know, before they sent you down to the camp.
Right.
And then when they did finally open the door to send you down to the camp, you know, they changed your clothes because you're inside the USP the quarantine. You're wearing orange. And when you're going down to the camp, you're not wearing orange. You put on a white t-shirt. You're tan. You know, at least in Lewisburg, it was tan. And they take you to the front of the USP and they say, oh, there's the camp down there. Just follow that path. Go down those stairs. There'll be a guy waiting for you. So me and four other guys, we have our little bag of clothing or whatever. And we're like, we just walk without a guard? Like we, you know, it was a very surreal experience. It didn't feel right, you know, because you get used to that. You know, your movements are controlled by, you know, this guy tells you where to go and where to go. And now they're just telling you to go down to the camp and walk down. And it was a totally shocking experience. I went from being locked in every day to walking around all day, pretty much.
Well, and you entered custody at a really just horrendous time with COVID going on and obviously in 22, you know, we were the worst part of it, but we were still having that, you know, like you said, the quarantine and with the social distancing, and of course CARES Act was still in place. And on top of that, the Bureau was rolling out the time credits. They, you know,
right. It was a perfect storm.
It was. And
the other thing is I was delayed 17 and a half months between the end of my trial and my sentencing. So, you know, this is what made me think that, hey, maybe God, or if you don't believe in God, the universe needed me in there right when the FSA was rolling out, right when CARES Act was at, because I was capable of understanding and able to help fellow inmates, you know, apply for CARES Act. And I did. I helped fellow inmates apply for it. I helped them understand the FSA to the best of my ability. And so, I did not have the opportunity to self-surrender because of the delay. You know, my judge said, hey, we've been sitting on this for almost a year and a half. Let's just get it over with. You don't have a problem with it. Of course I did, but I got taken and I spent a month at the Lackawanna County prison in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and then another 3 weeks in Columbia County before there was a marshal able to take me to my facility. And then from there, I went to, you know, 10 days in quarantine. So very traumatic experience.
My hat's off to you, man, because even though you were a camper, you were in the USP, you've been in county jails, you've been locked down, you've been...
You got the full prison
experience, man.
I got the full thing, right. And again, it goes back to, like, why was my sentencing delayed 17 and a half months? Would it be by coincidence that I get in there and the program statement comes out a few months later where everybody says, one guy said to me when I was in there, he's like, Dory, you used to be a lawyer. You're like a doctor and you're on an island full of sick people and you're the only doctor. Don't you think you could help some of these guys understand some of these things? And that kind of analogy kind of resonated with me. It's like, yeah, you know what? What am I going to be doing with my time? So finish landscaping, take my shower, get counted, and go to the library and sit there, review things, understand it, and answer people's questions. And I did that every day. Anybody who came to me, I had no problem trying to say, here's the program statement. Let's go over how it's supposed to work, you know. And what they did with it, what they did with that information was with them. You know, but I was happy to try to help. So I did not think it was a coincidence that everything happened at once.
Well, things happen for a reason.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, we had the program statement didn't roll out until November. And then right. We had those two successive program statements. As I like to say, it was the law was passed under one administration and elections have consequences and it was implemented under another. And there were a lot of changes in between there on how it was going to be done, which delayed the rules language being published, delayed us getting the process started. But yeah, that first year was, I know.
Tumultuous, yeah. Well, like I said earlier, when I first got there, I had understood that there was the First Step Act because my lawyer and I prepared. And so I got in there, I'm like, oh yeah, with First Step, and the inmates were telling me, oh, they're not doing that here. I'm like, well, what do you mean they're not doing that here? Well, they're doing manual calculations, and you're lucky if you get some. So wait a second.
Was he part of the paper pattern era?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So, yes.
Yes, paper patterns were in place, and those didn't leave until April of 23, when the
pattern right before I left.
Right before you left. And, of course, that
– Yeah, and I remember the – Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
The mess it was on your FSA assessments when they didn't have a record of your, oh, you didn't have this team meeting, so you're only getting 10. It was a big, I was leaving.
Well, and even more than that, you know, on pattern, adult continuing education classes are counted. They still are. In the automated pattern, of course, they're looking at the codes that, like, unless you know what group codes are, you don't know what those are. But so the case managers were like looking at what the name of the class was. And if it said adult continuing education, said it was an ACE course, it was like, oh, that's an ACE course. And if it looked like it was a vocational course, well, that's a vocational course. Not knowing about those codes that are behind the scenes. And so they were just relying on the description. And of course, you had everything at one facility. What we were seeing was from folks would go from one facility to the next or one case manager to the next. And the next case manager would go, oh, well, no, you don't have 9, you only have 6 classes that count. So the automation was a huge deal toward accuracy with pattern. But yeah, that would have been the month before you went out. But in January, we were doing the manual calculations. And that was just a delightful period of time for myself as well in DC, trying to explain it to everyone.
Sure.
Because it was me and the computer folks.
I imagine that was pretty difficult.
That's fun.
Because there were times where, you know, as inmates, we would go over the program statement, for example, and we commit it to memory. Because what do you do as an inmate? You read. You sit in your bunk and you read and you read and you reread and you outline, you sketch. Then you'd go talk to your case manager, and he'd be like, I don't know. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. I know it just came out. I know I'm supposed to do something. I just don't know what to do. So I felt like, you know, there was a missed opportunity for the BOP to educate people before they rolled this out and everybody.
Well, and funnily enough, in 19, they actually did that. In late 19 and early 2020, before the pandemic, there was on-site training for everyone. And then the election happened and how they were going to do it changed. And then we were in the pandemic. So going back out and trying to unlearn and relearn what for everybody became a problem. So yeah, absolutely. The lack of being able to meet in person with everyone really was, as a trainer, that was horrible because I was trying to train people over Teams meetings and Zoom and such.
One of our favorite sayings is the Bureau of Prisons is building the plane as it flies it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a fair analogy. Yeah. I think so. I haven't experienced it myself. I think so.
Well, and then we would be in a meeting and Maine Justice would be like, no, you got to do this. You got to do that. And so then we're recoding and it was a major shift from the bar to the Garland administration, just on how credits were going to be counted and how they were going to accumulate. If you had a chance to read the comments back from the first publishing of the rules language.
We're going to process these 1 week. I think I lost you guys for a minute there.
Oh,
but yeah, like 1 week. Oh, we're not our CARES Act. Everybody with an approval. Sorry. And then the next week. Well, all right. We're going to process people up to May 1st and then into June, and nobody knew what it was. And I think that's another thing that adds to anxiety when you're in a situation like that is not knowing. You don't know when you're leaving. You don't know what your out date is. That really, to me, that's the most stressful thing. So somebody going in now, you know, they don't know when they're leaving. They have an idea, but it's hard to tell them when you're leaving.
Right. Well, in the conditional release date calculators, which were, of course, the first one was released after you were into the community, that conditional home confinement date was, what, October of 2023. And then, of course, this past October, the conditional placement date information was rolled out. And so then we had, I think, the opposite of all of this data, all of this information. And I know in talk with case managers, that just the inundation of data and all of these folks who weren't on their radar or needing a halfway house were now, I got to do it right now because now they're right there. Their date's right there. So I think it'll eventually level out.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that there was a log jam of people, you know, that if you know, close to the door, they needed halfway house referrals and home confinement referrals. And it was just inevitably, you have to break that logjam somehow. And then everything started flowing. But, you know, I saw that coming from a mile away in November of 23, when they released the program statement and all the time periods when they're supposed to refer people, you know, 1 year before or 60 days, whichever is greater. Yeah, I thought, wow, that's going to be a whole bunch of people just jamming at that door. I don't know what they're going to do. You know, that was the thought, you know.
Right.
Down the road, you know, it'll probably be okay and work a little bit more smoothly, but I saw that coming.
Well, we had that one in the fall of 22, and then the fall of 23, we had another one with the conditional release date, and now fall of 24, we had another one. And now we're we're kind of in a difficult situation with these conditional placements. So there's a lot of folks that are needing to get halfway house dates, which is pushing out the SCA placements, the Second Chance Act placements. That's
I've been following that, of course. Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
So, well, I think we're getting,
we're at about 5 minutes. Real quick, do you have any advice or any tips you'd give to somebody who's either coming in or anywhere in the journey or anything? For
I do.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do. And it comes down from I did a lot of church activities in Lewisburg. And one of the guys I did rosary group with, you know, he saw me down one day, really kind of, and, you know, he was coming up on his release. And he said, listen, you know, you're 50 years old. You're going to be 50 years old soon. You spent 16 months in here or 15 months, whatever it was in here. When you, 10 years from now, when you look back on that 15 months, you're barely going to remember it. It's a blip on your screen. It's 0.03% of your life if you live to 80, you know, and that kind of gave me a little bit of perspective, you know, kind of kept me going. And I try to tell people that, you know, anybody, family members reach out to me and say, oh, my loved one's going in or whatever, you know, try to give them that pep talk that, you know, understand that you're both doing time. It's not just the inmate. You're doing it on the outside too. So support him and he'll support you as much as he can. And in the end, it's going to be a little blip on your radar screen, but, you know, and also encourage them to learn the FSA and everything and advocate on behalf of them. You know, there's no harm in getting on, you know, any website or talking to somebody or understanding so that there's a little less uncertainty in your mind and you know what's going on and, you know, that kind of gives you some peace. So those are the two bits of advice. It's going to go by quickly and learn the system as much as you can so that you could have some kind of peace knowing what your loved one's going to go through. That's my only advice.
Great advice. We advocate all the time about educating yourself. That's why we wrote the book, because we want people to understand. We want them to understand the process from the Bureau's perspective. We wrote the book as educational, not advocating right or left or in the middle. We took some heat because some folks felt like we were towing the Bureau line, but understanding how the Bureau is implementing it.
Yeah.
It's their talk and their chalkboard at that point. And that was our goal, was to educate folks on how it is, not what it might be or could be.
Right. And, you know, and I'm happy when, if somebody reaches out to me and says, hey, tell me what the First Step Act is, I'll go through it with them. You know, this is what it says, is what the program statement says. This is it, you know, and happy to do that for anybody that wants to understand the system or what's the SCA or what does RRC mean? You know, these are simple questions that I'm happy to answer.
Do that on the site, man. Do that on the site. Cause
I do. I tell everybody RRC. You know. I try it. I'm my best. I'm not always available, but you understand.
I understand. Right. Well, man, Dory, thanks for coming out on the show today. It means a lot, man. That just flew by. We're under a minute and a half left of airtime here.
Sure did. Thanks so much for having me. It's a great opportunity.
For folks that are on the Facebook, our Facebook group, First Step Act Early Release from Federal Prison, Dory's a member. You can look him up there and you see his posts as well. So again, thanks for being on the show, folks. It's been another great episode here on Around the Block, and come see our past shows archived on LA Talk Radio site. We're on Apple Podcasts now, which is fantastic. We're going to be branching out from there. Federal Prison Authority has its own Facebook group. We have the shows on it, and we have a First Step Act YouTube channel. So the usual social. So feel free And if you see the video and you have the ability to have a comment or ask a question for us, please do so. And we answer all our questions on the next show. So please do that. All right, then.
You want to talk about the books?
And of course, yes.
And while you get those, next week we are going to talk about the recent directive and the cut of Second Chance Act time. And we're going to kind of dig into that. So those are the books. The blue book is the time credits book, and the green book is classification. And Like I said, that's one we actually wrote with some lawyers in mind, several lawyers in mind. So thank you for joining us today. Dory, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
And we'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. Be blessed.
Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.